This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's a new biography of Elijah Muhammad, who led the Nation of Islam from 1934 to his death in 1975. My guest is the author, Carl Evans, an online editor at The Washington Post. Evans says that Elijah Muhammad's life has many different meanings, depending on who you ask. To his followers, he was the prophet. To many Jewish groups, he was an anti-Semite. Many Orthodox Muslims see him as a heretic. Some people believe he instigated the assassination of his former disciple, Malcolm X. Evans' book is based in part on FBI documents he requested through the Freedom of Information Act. Evans' new book is also about Wallace D. Fard, who founded the Nation of Islam and introduced Elijah Muhammad to Islam. Elijah Muhammad had a serious drinking problem when he met Wallace D. Fard in Detroit in 1930. Evans says Elijah Muhammad was overwhelmed by Fard's presence.
He looks at him and he's mesmerized, not only by the way the man looks, but by his speaking patterns and the way he's dressed and everything else. Again, Fard was a very charismatic person who soon attracted more than 7,000 members to the Nation of Islam. So Elijah Poole was just one of many who found him mesmerizing. He basically told Elijah Muhammad some very profound things. He would say, for example, if you stop eating pork, I can revolutionize your health. If you saved a little money, I can make you a very rich man. So he had all these enticements out there that Elijah Muhammad found too intriguing to ignore. And he soon converted him. And as I said, he taught him for the next 3.5 years everything he knew, things about the Kabbalah, Freemasonry, Christianity, Judaism, and everything else. And basically gave Elijah Muhammad a re-education.
Now, Wallace D. Fard, his real identity was different from who he claimed to be. Who did he claim to be when he met Elijah Muhammad?
Wallace D. Fard arrived in Detroit and claimed to be the Messiah expected at the end of time. He said that he was a prophet who had come to deliver black people to the Holy Land. He said he was from Saudi Arabia and that he descended from the royal family of the tribe of Quraysh, from which the prophet Muhammad ibn Abdullah came, that is the founder of the Islamic religion.
What was his real background?
He was actually born in New Zealand to a Pakistani father and to a mother who was white-skinned, and not only white-skinned, but Jewish by birth. She was raised, though, the Muslims say, by Muslims. So she practiced Islam, and he was, in effect, a mulatto who left New Zealand at an early age, I think around the age of 17 or so, and arrived in America via Canada around 1913.
I believe it was his first wife who he told he was white.
Yes, and in fact, there are marital records in the FBI's files, which are online, by the way, at FBI.gov, that show clearly that Fard, or Wallace D. Fard, which was his real name, was listed as a Caucasian.
How did Elijah Muhammad end up taking over the Nation of Islam?
What happened in 1932, November 21st to be exact, a Muslim in Detroit killed another man. The reason he killed him was because he had held a sacrificial murder in his apartment. Fard had taught that in order to go to heaven or to Mecca, his followers had to kill 4 white people or 4 people who were unrighteous. And so this man was regarded as unrighteous by this Muslim named Robert Kareem, and he's killed in Robert Kareem's apartment. Robert Kareem's 2 young children are watching this entire incident, as are 12 members of the Nation of Islam who have to bear witness. After the murder, the police come because they hear the kids screaming, you know, telling their father not to kill this man. And the police arrive and they arrest Kareem. In custody, Kareem says that his God is Wallace D. Fard. So the police go to the Fraymore Hotel in Detroit, find Fard, arrest him, and take him into custody. They book him and tell him that if he doesn't leave Detroit, he will be indicted as an accessory to murder. So rather than be indicted, Fard decides to leave Detroit, and he stays away for exactly 6 months. He sneaks back into Detroit in May 1933 and again is arrested at the Fraymore Hotel. At that point, he leaves the nation permanently and goes back to Los Angeles. So that was the disappearance. Once he leaves, though, Elijah Muhammad begins to teach something different. He says that Wallace D. Fard was not the prophet of God, but in fact was God himself, and that he, Elijah Muhammad, is the prophet now. He's the last messenger of Allah. So this is how he established his base of authority, of his rise to power.
What are some of the other claims that Elijah Muhammad ended up making about himself?
Well, he made many claims. He said that there was a mother plane, for example, hovering above this country that only he could see, and that this plane was going to ring out bombs once Allah gave the signal, that is to say, once Wallace D. Fard gave the signal, and completely destroy America. It would destroy Europe, Russia, and America, and everybody else. And that, in fact, these bombs would kill all the white people in the world and only leave minority races to run the world. That was one of the teachings. He also talked about his ability to communicate with Martians. And he said that life actually began on Mars and that he had seen Martians. He described them, of course, a description fitting the typical Martian description that you hear in the sci-fi novels. He also taught that he, again, was the final link between heaven and earth, and that once he converted 144,000 African-Americans to Islam, he would then have to go throughout the world and re-educate Muslims all over the country whom he said were believing in a false Islam. In other words, he said the Orthodox Muslims were not really practicing Islam, that the only real true Islam was the one that he taught.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Carl Evans. He's the author of the new book, The Messenger, The Rise and Fall of Elijah Muhammad. You know, your book has many different stories that you follow. There's, of course, the story of Elijah Muhammad. There's also the story of the FBI and yes. How it attempted to infiltrate the Nation of Islam and how it attempted to destroy the nation. What were some of the tactics that the FBI used to try to discredit the Nation of Islam?
Well, they tried everything under the sun. This included trying to destroy Elijah Muhammad's marriage to his wife, Clara. It included planting newspaper stories where it talked about Wallace D. Fard being a Nazi criminal who had escaped and come to America. That was one of the early stories that the press did pick up, by the way. It planted stories claiming that that Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X were having a bitter feud, which was not true at the time, but which became a self-fulfilling prophecy. And they used everything they could think of, essentially. They tried to, for example, pay members of the Nation of Islam to become informants, and some actually did.
One of the techniques that the FBI used to try to infiltrate the Nation of Islam was to cover up the faces of some of the white agents with shoe polish and other
yes.
black cosmetics.
Yes, that was one of the more hilarious things that they did. And in 1941, again, after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the FBI is gravely concerned about the Japanese influence within the nation. And rather than hire black agents, they do, as you said, got makeup artists to put black makeup on agents' faces, white FBI agents' faces and hands, and crop their hair very short, and send them to visit the mosque around the country, thinking they had fooled these people, by the way, fooled the Muslims into believing that they were black. But as one letter points out, that's mentioned in the book, by the way, the secretary said that there were four white devils here tonight. She was writing to Elijah Muhammad. She says, four white devils came to the mosque tonight trying to get in. They were ridiculously dressed, and they looked like fools. So the makeup didn't fool anyone, probably because their eyes, I would suppose, gave them away. I would imagine they were probably brown-eyed or blue-eyed or whatever, but clearly did not look like black people with this bad makeup job on.
My guest is Carl Evans, author of the new book, The Messenger, The Rise and Fall of Elijah Muhammad. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Carl Evans, author of a new biography of the former leader of the Nation of Islam, Elijah Muhammad. Part of the book is based on documents that Evans got declassified through the Freedom of Information Act. What did the FBI do to create a rift, or to try to create a rift, between Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X?
They began to send forged letters with Malcolm's signature forged to Elijah Muhammad, saying various nasty things, or a letter purportedly written by Malcolm X, where he was talking to someone else about undermining Elijah Muhammad. At the same time, they would send Malcolm X letters with Elijah Muhammad's signature saying nasty things, and also send tapes or phony tapes and transcripts of tapes saying that Elijah Muhammad was out to discredit Malcolm X. So they caused confusion in that sense. And they leaked stories to the press saying that Malcolm X was trying to take over the Nation of Islam and that Elijah Muhammad was furious about it. So gradually, Elijah Muhammad began to believe some of this misinformation, and it led to Malcolm's ouster. When Malcolm made the comment about President Kennedy being assassinated as a case of the chickens coming home to roost, Elijah Muhammad used that as a pretext to get rid of Malcolm X.
Do you think of the FBI as being behind the assassination of Malcolm X, even though they didn't orchestrate the actual assassination?
Yes. Well, again, the FBI took credit for creating the atmosphere, but you certainly can't blame the entire thing on the FBI. Again, once the scandal broke, Elijah Muhammad became determined that Malcolm X would not use the scandal to destroy the Nation of Islam. So early on, after the scandal breaks, this is, when I say early on, I mean by the summer of 1963, Elijah Muhammad is already talking about having Malcolm killed. There's one conversation in the book, for example, where Elijah Muhammad is talking to Minister Farrakhan, and he says, and very clearly he says, we have to close his eyes, referring to Malcolm X. In August of 1964, Elijah Muhammad calls a meeting of all his top laborers, which include all of his ministers and the top officials in the Nation of Islam. These are only men, by the way. The laborers are men. And at this meeting, Elijah Muhammad spoke for 7.5 hours. And he says repeatedly that Malcolm X is the chief hypocrite who must be stopped at all costs. So clearly, Elijah Muhammad was as culpable as the FBI in provoking the situation which led to Malcolm X's assassination.
Of course, some of the rift between Malcolm X and Elijah Muhammad had to do with Malcolm X's own growth. For instance, his visit to Mecca, in which he was introduced to a more orthodox form of Islam.
Yes.
that didn't coincide with the teachings of Elijah Muhammad.
Right. It was true Islam that he met, that he was introduced to really for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And when Malcolm X did make the Hajj in 1964. He had come to the realization that indeed white-skinned Muslims existed all over the world and that they were just as bona fide a Muslim as anyone else. So again, you mentioned that the break would have come ultimately anyway. That's very true. Malcolm X was a very brilliant man and was not about to allow dogma to stand in the way of the truth.
Elijah Muhammad died of congestive heart failure in 1975. Louis Farrakhan took over leadership of the Nation of Islam, still is in that leadership position. Do you know what Elijah Muhammad thought of Farrakhan and if he had hoped that Farrakhan would succeed him?
I don't think he ever hoped or believed that Farrakhan would succeed him. In fact, he said that since he was the seal of God's prophets, that is, the last messenger of God, there was no need for a successor. And so that, in that sense, he didn't believe Wallace Muhammad, his son, or Farrakhan, or anyone else would have to come along behind him. What he did say was that after he died, there would be a new Islam in this country. And he never specified how it would be new and different. His son, though, said, Wallace Muhammad said that, in fact, his father wanted to move the nation away from race-based religion to true Islam. And this is one of the things that Wallace Muhammad did immediately upon his father's death. Also, the book points out for the first time that Elijah Muhammad, in 1964, completely changed his beliefs about white people, that he has recorded interviews where he says, we have to stop calling the white man the devil because we got plenty of black devils out there, too, and that evil knows no race, creed, or color. This is something that Minister Farrakhan has completely ignored for more than 25 years, but I'm hoping with this recent epiphany that he announced in Chicago that he will finally accept the truth of that and tell his followers that, in fact, Elijah Muhammad was ready at the time of his death to bring the Nation of Islam into true Orthodox Islam.
I wasn't aware that Farrakhan had said that.
Yes, well, he had an epiphany recently again. He said where he had had a near-death experience, and he was only 3 minutes away from death, according to his own doctors, and that as a result of that, he was going to stop preaching hate and start preaching that all men are created equal in God's eyes, and he was going to make other revelations on February 26 of this year, which is the so-called Savior's Day, which is held in Chicago usually.
You're very critical of the Nation of Islam and of Elijah Muhammad, but I'm wondering if you think that the Nation has also done a lot of good in helping people in prison, teaching discipline, teaching good diet,
yes,
telling people to refrain from taking drugs, things like that.
Yeah, again, the book is called The Rise and Fall, so there's obviously the negative aspect, but again, there's the light side or the bright side, where the Nation of Islam really was a powerful force in the black community. They talked about, you know, the evils, for example, of eating pork, how it affected the human body. So they talked about eating clean meat and only eating meats recommended by, you know, for example, the Holy Bible or the Quran. Eat properly, take care of yourself, don't smoke, don't drink, become economically independent, that is to say, try to get a job. If you can't find a job in the public sector or the private sector, I will give you a job. In other words, he was telling his people to be good citizens, which is kind of ironic because he said America was falling, but he preached over and over and over again that the bottom line was that we had to be good citizens and by virtue of that saying, be good Americans. So he did a great deal of good, in other words, and it's the bottom line, I think.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Carl Evans, author of the new book, The Messenger, The Rise and Fall of Elijah Muhammad. Have you ever had any personal connections to the Nation of Islam? Did you ever consider joining when you were younger, or have people close to you who were members?
Yes, as I say, you know, some of my best friends are Muslims. I have an uncle who's actually a member of the Los Angeles mosque headed by Farrakhan right now. He's been in there for over 25 years. I had many friends in high school who joined the Nation of Islam, and I considered joining the Nation of Islam when I was about 17 in the late 1960s.
Why did you want to join then?
They were doing the only positive things that I saw in the black community. I grew up in the ghetto in St. Louis, and, you know, we had street gangs and a lot of what amounted to self-hatred going on. The Muslims came along, and they were always well-dressed, always, you know, looking healthy, and always talking about peace and brotherhood. So I was attracted to that. I mean, they were regarded as, you know, the most awesome black group in the black community. So I began visiting their mosque there in St. Louis and seriously considered joining. Only after I saw the dark side of the Nation of Islam did I reconsider that as an option.
How did you get exposed to that dark side?
Well, I had a friend, a young man named Tommy, who had gone to the mosque with me one Sunday. Tommy had a drug problem, and he also had an alcohol problem. And this day, he had had something to drink and was not sober. At any rate, he was sitting a few rows behind me, and he stood up at one point during the discussion and asked the minister, how was it possible for black people to create a black nation when we had very few doctors and lawyers and engineers and all that? And the minister was outraged by the statement for some reason. He just flew off the handle. And when he did that, when he expressed his dismay over Tommy's comment, four or five guards attacked Tommy and beat him mercilessly. They kicked him in the face, in his eye, and just, you know, started administering karate chops and everything and beat him horribly. When I saw Tommy after the incident, they held him, by the way, and dismissed everyone else. The next time I saw Tommy, he had blood spots in his eye. His face was completely swollen up. They had knocked out one of his teeth. And when I saw that barbarity by someone who professes to love black people, I was completely alienated about the Nation of Islam at that point.
I'm wondering, when you meet people in the Nation of Islam who either read your book or have listened to you tell them about your findings and about,
yes,
for instance, finding that that the founder of the Nation of Islam, Wallace D. Fard, was really a fraud.
A petty criminal, right.
Yeah, that he'd been a petty criminal, that he built this phony identity for himself. Do the people who are in the Nation think that you're wrong, or does it make them reconsider the teachings within the Nation?
Again, some are reacting positively in that they have an open mind and they are really willing to consider the founder's background. The comparison I like to draw for them to make them more, you know, amenable to listening to what I'm saying is that you have to bear in mind that Elijah Muhammad also had a criminal record, which is discussed in the book. I mean, you know, the drinking thing, and he was charged with contributing to the delinquency of minors at one point in his life. Malcolm X had an extensive criminal record, but that didn't change who they became. And so my argument is that Wallace D. Fard, yeah, he had a shady background and even a criminal background, but he tried to change his life in midstream and became at least respectable in the black community's eyes. Everything he did, of course, was not positive. In fact, much of it was far from positive. But the point is that anyone is capable of changing. And in fact, this is where Louis Farrakhan is today. He's been preaching racial hatred and anti-Semitism for over 40 years. But now he's come to the realization that this is a new era and that no one is going to keep buying that argument. And he's now announcing or claiming to announce or preparing to announce that he's going to change the focus of his group.
Well, Carl Evans, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Carl Evans is the author of The Prophet, The Rise and Fall of Elijah Muhammad. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the new popularity of the word virtual. This is Fresh Air.